Hello, this is David Murphy. Today is February 20th, 2026. I'll be reading from The New Yorker, publication date February 23, 2026. I begin with losing faith in atheism. I spent years searching for a livable, secular worldview, but none of them quite offered the same value of belief. By Christopher Biha. Early in my freshman year of college, a speeding car struck my twin brother Jim on a street near our campus. These were pre-cell phone days, but I happened to be in my dorm room when the call came in, so I got to ride with my brother in the ambulance. Our sister, Alice, who is in the year ahead of us, arrived soon after at the hospital. Shortly after, the orderlies wheeled Jim away to be intubated. An intensive care doctor explained to me and Alice that our brother was suffering from acute respiratory failure. This man, whom we'd never seen before, casually added that Jim was unlikely to make it to morning. When he continued on his rounds, the first thing we did once he left was pray. We'd been raised in a devout Catholic home, attending Mass every Sunday and on holy days of obligation, saying grace before meals, prayers before bed, and rosary on long car rides, constantly adding sick or troubled loved ones to our intentions list. At the hospital, praying together was a distraction, but it was also an act that we believed to have some power to help our brother live through the night. As it happened, he did live through it. His recovery was long, months stretched into years, but ultimately complete. I thanked God for that. But the memory of that first night, when I thought I was losing him forever, stayed with me. The recognition of radical human vulnerability pushes some people towards belief, but for me, it had the opposite effect. On campus that spring, I started skipping Mass. This proved to be the initial step on a path that eventually led to my rejection of the faith in which I'd been raised. An answered prayer made me an atheist. In many ways, those years, the turn of the 21st century, were an ideal time to be a budding unbeliever. In 2004, an unknown writer named Sam Harris published The End of Faith, a short polemic on the existential threat that religion posed to Western civilization. In rapid succession, Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, 2006, Daniel Dennett's Breaking the Spell, 2006, and Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great, 2007, followed Harris's book onto the bestseller list, and the so-called Four Horsemen became the public face of a resurgent of new atheism. But I quickly discovered that I was not in the audience for these books. I wasn't looking to talk my way out of a belief in God. I was already out. I wanted to know what to believe in instead. If I was still in search of beliefs, many atheists would object. I hadn't really gotten over my religious upbringing. A good atheist deals not in faith, but in facts, not in belief, but in knowledge. Yet I could find no obvious factual, knowledge-based answers to the question that was most pressing to me. How am I to live? I don't mean to suggest that the new atheists had no moral sense. On the contrary, they were largely fueled by moral outrage at the needless suffering religion caused. But the nature of morality was seemingly the only thing about which they did not care to argue. They thought it was simply self-evident that we desire pleasure over pain for ourselves, and that any decent person wished the same for others. One of the religion's greatest harms, they believed, was that it turned people away from this basic intuition. Of the four horsemen, only Harris aspired to be a science of good and evil, which could subject moral claims to the same rational scrutiny as all other claims. But his chapter on the topic quickly devolves into an argument about the indefensibility of pacifism and the moral necessity of government torture. It was a strange time. Anyway, I wasn't really looking for practical guidance. To ask, how am I to live, is to inquire as to not just what is right, but what is good. It is to ask not just what should I do, but how should I be? The most generous interpretation of the new atheism viewed on this question is that people ought to have the freedom to decide for themselves. On that, I agree completely, but that left me right where I started, still in need of an answer. Setting down the popular polemics of the day, I began to read modern philosophy, which I understood to be the primary means by which humans have sought secular answers to life's questions. I read the philosophers most frequently cited as models by modern-day atheists, John Locke, David Hume, John Stuart Mill, as well as those whom meaning-hungry young people and habitually embrace as secular gurus, Friedrich Nietzsche, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Albert Camus. But I also read philosophers who are mostly read just by other philosophers. Even when I was struggling with the most challenging of these works, the reading felt urgent to me. I wasn't submitting papers or getting grades. I wasn't looking to earn a degree or pursue a career. I wasn't even trying to impress people at literary parties. For that, I had 1,000-page postmodern novels. I was just trying to figure things out. Immanuel Kant's three critiques are often cited as the works that first made philosophy inaccessible to non-specialists. But in Kant's opinion, he was addressing very straightforward questions. What can I know? What must I do? And what may I hope? I was decidedly a non-specialist, and these were the questions I wanted answered. Among other things, this reading taught me that atheists do hold beliefs, not just about morals and ethics, but about how the world actually is and how humans fit into it. Of course, not all atheists hold the same beliefs, just as not all theists do. But I found that modern atheist belief tends to cluster into two broad traditions. The most prevalent atheist worldview goes by many names. Empiricism, positivism, physicalism, naturalism, but the term that best captures the fullness of its present-day iteration, as I see it, is a scientific materialism. Roughly speaking, this view holds that the material world is all that exists, that humans can know this world through sense perception, that the methods of science allow us to convert the raw data of these perceptions into general principles, and that these principles can be both tested and put to practical use by making predictions about future events. As worldviews go, scientific materialism has a lot to say for it. It tells us the humans are capable, without any supernatural aid, of coming to understand and ultimately to master all of reality. It tells us that the store of human knowledge is constantly increasing and continuously improving our material conditions. To this end, it points to the astonishing human progress that has occurred in the time of science's reign, and it encourages us to enjoy the fruits of this progress as much as possible, since our life here on Earth is the only one we'll get. Most people who subscribe to the scientific materialism take it to be so obviously correct that it could not be denied by any rational person who truly understands it. But my reading showed me that this worldview has its shortcomings. The most basic is perhaps inherent to any worldview at all. It rests on a set of principles which often can't be proven, even by the standards of proof the worldview embraces. The general principle that all real knowledge is derived from the sense of perception of material facts cannot itself be derived from the perception of facts in the world, and thus can't really be sanctioned by scientific materialism's own methods. Indeed, no general principle can be. The very legitimacy of deriving general principles from the particulars of experience can never be established from experience without already having the principle in hand. This so-called problem of induction was first identified not by any counter-enlightenment reactionary, but by Scottish empiricist David Hume. Earlier empiricists like Locke and Francis Bacon believed that the physical sciences should still be grounded partly in metaphysical belief. Hume became one of modern atheism's great intellectual heroes by rejecting this idea. But he didn't substitute some other foundation in its place. Instead, he argued that we should simply do without foundations entirely, apart from the rather shaky ones of custom, habit, and expedience. That has been more or less the scientific materialist answer to the problem ever since. Scientific materialism just works. If by works one means that it can be put to good use, this is unquestionably so. But if we mean that it captures within its frame all the notable features of our experience, that's a different matter. In fact, what materialism can't adequately capture is experience itself. Consciousness is not material, not publicly available through sense perception, not subject to the kinds of observation that scientific materialism takes as the hallmark of knowledge. By the standards of the materialist worldview, it simply doesn't exist. For me, this limitation proved fatal. I spent far too much time within the confines of my mind to accept a worldview that told me whatever was going on in there wasn't real. Luckily, I'd by then come into contact with the other great family of modern atheist belief, which I eventually came to call the Romantic Idealism. This is the atheism of Nietzsche and Martin Heidegger, and their existential descendants, which begins in precisely the place where scientific materialism leaves off, with the will of the subjective conscious agent. At its most extreme, romantic idealism treats each of us as willing our own world into being, creating the reality in which we live, even when it doesn't go quite this far. It treats our subjective experience as the proper subject of knowledge. In fact, the only thing we can ever be said to know. Romantic idealism arose in the post-Enlightenment era, and it grew in opposition to the principles of Enlightenment rationality as much as it did to religious authority. Although atheism is often associated with hyper-rationality, this form of its unapologetically irrational, in place of reason, observation, and scientific study, it valorizes emotion, imagination, and artistic creativity. The ethics of romantic idealism are ethics of authenticity. The greatest good is not maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain, but living in a way that is true to our subjective reality. The movement rejects religious belief not for being empirically false, but for being ready-made and inherited response to existential problems that we must work out for ourselves. The appeal of this worldview, particularly for a young person engaged in just such a working out, should be obvious, and I soon found myself enthralled to it. Like scientific materialism, romantic idealism does not have a solid foundation in any provable universal truth, but it reveals in this condition. It is the lack of any such foundation that makes it possible for each of us to construct our own truth. This relativism carries clear dangers. Since the time of Locke, empiricism has been closely linked with political liberalism, whereas romantic idealism is associated with rather darker political forces. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, one of the founders of Romanticism, was a great inspiration for the French Revolution's Reign of Terror. He argued that liberalism's supposed universal rights were covers for bourgeois self-interest. This argument was later developed at great length by Nietzsche, one of several thinkers in this tradition who inspired the rise of fascism. A more basic problem with romantic idealism occurs on the personal level. Building meaning from scratch turns out to be an incredibly difficult task. The romantic idealist approach is fraught with fear and trembling. A fact it doesn't deny, it is not a route to happiness. Indeed, it seems to hold the goal of happiness in contempt. Mankind does not strive for happiness, Nietzsche wrote. Only the Englishman does that. Many romantic idealist writers have been fascinated by the problem of suicide. The problem, in their view, being that there is no good reason not to do it. It was this element of romantic idealism which finally led to my rejection of it. I grew tired of being unhappy and anxious all the time, of constantly questioning whether life was worth the trouble. One cause of the feeling, for me, was that the materialists had it right on an important point. There is, indeed, a world outside our hands that cannot be ignored or overpowered through force of will. And denying this is a recipe for misery. after nearly 20 years of searching unsuccessfully for a livable atheist worldview, I began in my mid-30s to entertain the possibility that atheism itself might be part of the problem. There were many steps from here to my eventual return to robust belief, but I started with the notion that for me, the authentic life might be one of faith. Excuse me. One that recognized the existence of both the external material world and the internal ideal world and sought to reconcile them, and one that accepted an absolute foundation to things and attempted to understand in some provisional and imperfect way the nature of this foundation and what it wanted from me. Roughly a decade has now passed since my return to atheistic belief. Barring some extreme change, this second period of faith will soon have lasted longer than my years of atheist wandering. Yet those years will always be with me, and I'm grateful for them. They have made me understand the world around me. One lately marked by sorrow and despair in a radically different way than I would have otherwise. The signal predicament of our era is the global rise of illiberalism and intolerance. Secular liberals who have observed these forces with quite justified horror have often linked them to a familiar enemy, religion. In their view, Christian nationalism is one of the primary ideologies behind right-wing illiberalism. Meanwhile, they tend to see the strain of left-wing thought, which rejects universalist liberal principles as equally under the sway of a kind of faith, the cult or the church of identity politics. Richard Dawkins of the God Delusion speaks for many of them when he declared woke to be a later day Torquemadism. With its own religiously enforced dogma. Religion is a famously malleable sociological category. But if we stick to the criterion of atheistic belief, the argument that modern-day illiberalism is primarily, a religious moment does not really hold up. Perhaps the crudest way to make the point would be simply to note the rise of illiberalism has gone hand in hand with the decline of theist belief and religious practice, both in the United States and around the world. The avatar of American illiberalism, Donald Trump, is the first president in generations who does not even pretend to be influenced or motivated by Christian faith. Trump is best understood as our first Nietzschean president, a man who explicitly embraces the will to power as the ultimate value, a force to which even the truth must give way. Many of the young and highly educated cohorts who populate the portions of the left most suspicious of universal liberal values are also among those least likely to identify as religious believers. In a different manner than Trump, they hold that so-called objective truths are expressions of power dynamics, tools used by the elite to oppress the marginalized. In place of these truths, they champion the importance of identity and authenticity. In other words, large groups of both the left and the right have become romantic idealists, and they have come to pose the same challenge to liberalism and scientific rationalism that romantic idealism has always posed to these traditions. Meanwhile, the failure of these traditions to respond adequately to the challenge is bound up with the problem identified by their earliest proponents. They have a very hard time articulating their foundational justification. When liberalism runs smoothly, it does a remarkable job delivering the goods it promises. For most people, this is a sufficient achievement to quiet any worries about its philosophical underpinnings. But when many people within liberal societies do not feel that the system is working, when the practical case for liberalism comes into question, secular liberals don't have much else to go on. For early liberals like Locke, it seemed obvious that liberalism, like empiricism, needed to be grounded in faith, even as it sought to enshrine tolerance for different varieties of belief. For Locke, the fact that we have immortal souls subject to eternal punishment and reward means that it's irrational to submit to a government that denies God's will, as we understand it, no matter how much coercive power that government has. At the same time, Locke had the empiricist's healthy suspicion that we could never have metaphysical certainty about what the Creator's will was, which meant that no person should impose his answer to that question on another. It is for these reasons that faith must be treated as a matter of personal conscience, but also, more generally, that a regime grounded in a social contract must be one that respects individual freedoms. Our status as creatures of God's confers on us certain rights that can't be handled over as part of the social contract. Rights that are at once natural and inalienable. Many of the founding fathers held this same view. But after Hume, liberals came increasingly to find even the barest invocation of metaphysical principles to be an embarrassment. The great post-Humean liberal theorist Jeremy Bentham called the idea of natural rights nonsense and the idea of inalienable natural rights nonsense on stilts. Some liberals have tried to hold on to such abstract concepts without the metaphysical framework in which they make sense, but many eventually came to the Humean conclusion that liberalism could simply do without foundations, so long as it got the job done. My own passage into and back out of unbelief, one marked by a close reading of works that earlier illiberal societies had attempted to suppress on religious grounds, has strengthened my liberal commitments. But it has also made me acutely aware of liberalism's very real limitations. As a means for allowing people with different conceptions of the good to live together fruitfully and peaceably, liberalism seems unmatched in human history. As a means of generating its own conceptions of goodness that feel compelling to most human beings, its record is quite mixed, perhaps because that's not what it was even designed to do. What's more, when liberals treat some version of the scientific materialism as so self-evidently true that it must serve as the default context for public discourse, when they make allegiance to reason and evidence as they define these terms, the price of admission into such discourse, and when they attempt to banish metaphysical or spiritual or even frankly religious talk from our politics and our culture, they're not practicing liberalism as its greatest exemplars understood it. They are eliminating from our shared vocabulary many of the concepts on which any justification for liberalism beyond the purely practical would have to depend. I am not suggesting that the solution to our problems is for secular liberals to find God, but I am suggesting that religious believers be considered natural allies in the fight against irrational illiberalism rather than its primary cause. This need not mean abandoning secularism. It certainly doesn't mean abandoning liberalism. It means, perhaps, seeing liberalism as so many liberals wish believers would see their faith, not as the expression of a universal truth to which every person must eventually submit, but as a human construction, one of the finest we have ever made, worth defending even when it's helpless to defend itself, yet capable of being swept away by the same hands that built it in the first place. So ends the article. The Trial of Gisele Pelicot's Rapist United France and Fractured Her Family. After 51 men were convicted, Pelicot became a feminist hero. But additional accusations left her children struggling to accept her new role by Rachel Aviv. Gisele Pelicot was sitting by a tennis court in October 2020, watching her granddaughter hit forehands when she saw that she'd missed a call. When she called back, a police officer named Laurent Perret asked if she was aware that a few weeks earlier her husband, Dominique, had been questioned by the police. A security worker at a supermarket had caught him filming under three women's skirts with his cell phone. Gisele, feeling a small sense of victory, explained to Perret that she already knew. She had told Dominique, "What you did was ridiculous," and urged him to see a therapist and apologize to the women. "I forgave him because I know it's not like him," she later told Perret. "I told him that we had to face this situation together." The Pelicots lived in a one-story yellow house with pale blue shutters and a swimming pool in Mazan, a village in Provence. They had moved there from Paris 7 years before, when Gisele retired. A few weeks after Perret's phone call, they drove to the police station for an appointment with him. Dominique wore dark green corduroy trousers and a pink polo shirt that Gisele had picked out the night before. "Don't worry, it's only a formality," she assured him. Gisele, who was 67, was taken into a private room where Perret asked her things about their marriage. "It was love at first sight," she responded. She and Dominique had met when they were 18. They'd been together for 49 years. "He is kind and thoughtful," she told Perret, according to the interview transcript. "He's a great guy. We get along well, which is why we're still together. He's not perfect, but those are his main qualities." When Perrette asked her about social life, she said that she and Dominique were close with a couple whom they'd known for more than 20 years. "We share the same values, family, grandchildren," she said. Perrette asked if she and her husband had ever been interested in swinging. "No, how awful," she responded. "I need feelings. I am not an open woman." Dizelle sensed Perrette's embarrassment. He told her that he'd found evidence that Dominique had been giving her sleeping pills mixed into her drinks so that men could rape her. "Do you think that is possible? Sorry, is plausible?" he asked. She began crying. "It's not possible," she said. He showed her photographs that he'd found on her husband's memory cards and computer, which had been confiscated after he was caught at the supermarket. "Do you recognize the female wearing a garter belt, lying on the bed, and appearing to be sleeping?" he asked. "Yes, that's me. It's my bedroom," she said. "I never sleep like that." She was struck by how floppy her cheek was. She told Perrette, "I don't know where I am anymore." He showed her another photo of a man in her bedroom with graying hair and a tattoo. "Do you recognize this location?" he asked. "Who's the guy?" she said. "I never wanted to have sex with him." When he mentioned a Skype username that her husband had used to communicate with her rapists, she said, "You're speaking Chinese to me." Perrette asked if she wanted to press charges. Her husband, he explained, had kept a list of more than 50 people in the past decade who'd rape her while she was unconscious. The thought of pressing charges hadn't occurred to Dizelle, but she said yes. An officer drove Dizelle home while Dominique stayed at the police station. "I got caught up in a vicious cycle," he confessed. "I realized that, with sleeping pills, it was very easy to get what I wanted, which I couldn't get otherwise, which was normal because it wasn't her way of life." He said that he had ruined his family. He was disgusted with himself. "I had fantasies that gradually came true, and I wanted to take them further," he said. When Dizelle got home, she put a load of laundry into the washing machine. Then she asked her closest friend in Marzahn to come over. As she waited, she hung Dominique's boxers and pajamas on a clothesline in her garden. It was good that the sun came out, she thought. His clothes will dry quickly. She did some ironing and vacuumed the bedrooms. The next morning, her three children, David, Caroline, and Florian, came from Paris to the police station to meet with Perrette, who filled them in on his investigation. As Dizelle drove them back to the Marzahn, she felt relieved that there was leftover pumpkin soup in the refrigerator and that she could serve for dinner. But her children were not interested in sitting down for a meal. Caroline, who was 41 and a communications manager, said that the house suddenly looked uglier and older and that she no longer liked the smell. She and her brothers started going through her father's drawers where they discovered unpaid bills. A few hours later, Perrette called Caroline and asked her to return to the station. He realized that he'd recognized her face. At the station, an officer showed her two photographs of her asleep in bed. In both pictures, she was lying on her side, her underwear exposed. "It should be noted that Mademoiselle Caroline Pellicott is shaking and informs us that she feels very ill," the officer wrote. "Let us suspend the meeting." When Caroline returned to the house, she later wrote, her mother looked up at her casually, as if I'd just come back from a pleasant walk. David, the oldest child, who works in marketing, had always credited his father with giving him a good education, values, a backbone, he told me. I decided very quickly to erase this man from my memory. He and Florian put Dominique's belongings in a trash bag and drove them to the dump. They made 10 trips. Carolyn destroyed framed photographs and art on the walls, as well as a trunk of family photo albums. I think my mother resented me for that, for being in that kind of frenzy, Caroline later said. Giselle remembers telling Caroline, don't break everything, please. There are things I'd like to keep. Of all her children, Caroline was the one that Giselle struggled with the most. She's one of those highly strung people who love and lose their temper in the same breath, Giselle writes in her new memoir, A Hymn to Life. She seems to have been filled since childhood with a feeling of insecurity that I have never really understood or been able to soothe. As a child, Caroline considered her father more motherly than my mother, she said. She described him as a dad who listened, who came to see me in my room, who came to sit on the edge of my bed and said, but Caroline, you can't say that. You can't believe like that. He helped all three of his children with their homework and played soccer with them and cooked for the family. After Caroline had her own child, she and her husband, Pierre, spent a few weeks every summer with her parents. In the evenings, they drank cocktails and played Trivial Pursuit, and sometimes stayed up until 1 a.m. talking. I adored this man, Pierre said later. Florian's wife, Aurora, was similarly struck by the family's rapport. I remember telling my husband that they were UFOs, she said. I, who came from a complicated family with taboos, arrived in a loving, demonstrative family. For me, it was a bit like the ideal family. Caroline didn't want to spend the night alone. She asked her mother to sleep in the guest room with her. It would have made things easier if I had snuggled up to my daughter, if we'd stayed all would it have done that? If we'd stayed up all night talking, Giselle writes. But she felt an urgent need to be alone in her own room. The scene of rape, but still my bed. In the morning, they discussed the two photos of Caroline, who thought she may have also been raped. Though I understood her suspicions, Giselle writes, I couldn't let them become certainties. When she asked Caroline if she was sure that the woman in the picture was her, Caroline felt that her mother didn't believe her. The three children decided that their mother could no longer live in the house. After spending 3 days cleaning it out, they all took a train to Paris. Giselle was to stay with her children, taking turns at each of their homes. David remembers looking at his mother at the train station and realizing that, of her former life, all that remained was a suitcase and her dog. Giselle felt like a 20-year-old girl. I understood that they wanted to erase that whole part of their lives, she told me. But if the last 50 years of my life were taken away from me, it would be very difficult for me to continue to live. You have to know where you come from to know where you're headed, Dominique wrote years before his arrest in a 30-page autobiography that he titled With My Own Troubles. He gave copies to Giselle and his children. I think of the day when I'll no longer be here and my family will learn about my past, which will undoubtedly help them grow in the love and shared values that I've tried to pass on to them, he wrote. The autobiography was written in a jolly tone. Life in Paris for a country bumpkin is no piece of cake, believe me, with an emphasis on the joys of soccer. But Dominique also described his father as authoritarian, a wolf, and a predator lurking in the shadows. His mother as too submissive and unable to leave. He devoted several passages to a bad arrival in the family, an adoption of a child named Nicole, who had lived in foster homes. His father took advantage of the situation to justify his needs with what he had at his disposal, Dominique wrote. After Dominique's mother died, his father and Nicole, who was then in her early 20s, began sharing a bedroom. I understand that a man can have needs, but not in this way. Each time he explored a dark subject, though, he wrapped it up quickly. But let's move on, or that's life. The narrative ends when he meets Giselle. The rest will be easy for us. We were happy and had many children. As the saying goes, the last words in the memoir are, thank you, life. Dominique had been an electrician and then a real estate agent, but he was often out of work and short on money. Giselle started her career as a secretary at France's main power company and was repeatedly promoted. She was surprised to eventually find herself in an executive position, supporting her family. She cared more about style and culture than Dominique did. When she took him to Madame Butterfly, he was bored for 3 hours, but they shared a sense of humor. There was a lot of irony, Caroline said. When it ever happened in our family, we could still laugh about it. They held parties for friends in their basement, which also had a disco ball hanging from the ceiling. I never saw him leer at women, Caroline said of her father. He never made inappropriate, out-of-line jokes. When Giselle and Dominique were having sex, Giselle writes, he occasionally called her, my bitch. The erotic cliché struck her as absurd. When he asked her to get a Brazilian wax, she said no. She would have been happy to just rest her head on his chest at night, but he preferred to have sex, and she settled into it about 5 times a month. Sometimes she even felt desire. Once, in a department store in Paris, she had to choose between 2 different pairs of underwear because she could only afford one. Without realizing it, Dominique stole the pair she'd left behind, slipping it into his pocket, but a security guard caught him. Giselle said that the salesperson was touched by the gesture, telling him, Madame, you mustn't be cross with your husband. One of Giselle's closest friends had been a colleague 9 years her junior, a single woman named Pascal, who often went on vacation with the Pellicots. Pascal considered Dominique very helpful, friendly, and fun-loving. Eventually, she said, he began hitting on her. Once on vacation, when she was alone, crying about a breakup, he embraced her and said, I've been dreaming about this for so long. At work, Pascal tried to confide in Giselle, telling her, you don't know who you're living with. You put him on a pedestal. But Giselle didn't ask Pascal what she meant. She couldn't tolerate the suggestion. She stopped acknowledging Pascal when they passed in the hallways. I suffered greatly from this breakup, Pascal said. Now, after spending several weeks living with Florian, Giselle called Pascal, with whom she hadn't spoken in 2 decades, and told her what had happened. Pascal invited her to spend the weekend at her house. They stayed up until 5 in the morning talking. We picked up where we left off, as if we'd only been apart for a day, Giselle told me. She wanted to know what Pascal had been trying to tell her years earlier. She thought it might foretell Dominique's crimes. But all Pascal had was an ordinary story of a cheating husband playing footsie with his wife's younger friend, as Giselle put it. Her children felt alienated when she tried to remind them that they'd had a good childhood, and that Giselle was comforted that, for Pascal, positive memories of the petticoat still felt alive. To her, we were a model couple, she told me. 6 weeks after Dominique's arrest, Giselle met with an investigative magistrate, Guignola Journeau, who would be interviewing everyone involved in the case. Giselle referred to Dominique as my husband before stopping herself. No, she said, I can't say my husband anymore. She started calling him the other one, or he. She was in the process of getting a divorce. The saddest thing is that I thought we were happy, she said. Giselle had no memories of being raped. But after she and Dominique moved to Mazen, she began having a recurring dream, which she now took on new significance. I was at our gate on the terrace, and I saw 2 officers, she told me. I approached them and asked them what they wanted, and they told me it was about a complaint concerning a woman in Monsieur Pellicot. I didn't understand this dream, so maybe my subconscious was giving me an answer, but I didn't grasp it. She told Journeau, the puzzle has finally fallen into place. Once, she explained, Dominique had handed her a beer that seemed to have a green tinge. She thought that he should return it to the store, but instead he immediately poured it down the sink. Another time, shortly after their move, she noticed a bleach-like stain on her new pair of yellow cotton pants. I thought to myself, this is strange because I have an excellent memory, and here I was, unable to remember what had happened the night before, she said to Journeau. She had asked Dominique teasingly, you wouldn't have drugged me by any chance, would you? He started crying. And he apologized, and she apologized, sorry. Some days would pass, and Giselle wouldn't remember whom she had talked to or what she had done. She had been 9 years old when her mother, who had a brain tumor, died. When I had these periods of absence, she told me, I thought that I might have the same illness as my mother, and that I could also just vanish. Her father, a professional soldier, had remarried to a cold woman who said things like, life's a shit sandwich and you gotta take a little bite of it every day. Giselle remembered her mother smiling as she died. Giselle took care to live that way too, cheerful even when doomed. Her father never appeared to recover from his grief and told her brother, and her older brother fell into depression. But Giselle described herself as a steadfast tin soldier of joy. She had seen 3 neurologists about the memory lapses, with Dominique accompanying her, but they couldn't determine what was wrong. They seemed to view her, Giselle thought, as just another old lady in decline. All 3 told me the same thing, she said to Journeau. You have an anxious disposition. One of Dominique's brothers, Joel, a doctor who had been the mayor of his town, concluded that she was fatigued from all the time she had spent taking care of her grandchildren in Paris. She went there any time they had a school vacation. Joel compared her to a vacuum cleaner bag stuffed to capacity. "They reassured me with the vacuum cleaner," she explained. Joel declined to comment. Caroline chose a lawyer for the family, Caddy Richard, who was known for her commitment to victims of sexual violence. She read Giselle and Caroline's transcripts of the interrogations of Dominique and the other rapists. They were being arrested in waves of about 10 at a time. Dominique had met many of them on Coco, a French messaging site, in a chat room called Without Her Knowledge. At his instruction, they often parked their cars at a school about 300 feet from the house. They abstained from smoking or wearing cologne. They warmed their hands on a radiator or in hot water and undressed in the laundry room. They left their clothes on the porch so that they could leave quickly if Giselle woke up. After the rapes, Dominique washed Giselle and changed her back into her pajamas. In this way, he erases the traces of his misdeeds and returns to his original position of idolizing his partner, a court psychiatrist wrote. Well, I think I'm going to end there, even though I haven't finished this article. This has been David Murphy reading to you. Thank you very much for listening to me.